LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. From the North American Review, August 2nd, 1907. Chapters from my autobiography, Chapter 21, by Mark Twain. From Susie's Biography of Me, February 12, 1886. Mama and I have both been very troubled of late because Papa, since he had been publishing General Grant's book, has seemed to forget his own books and work entirely. And the other evening, as Papa and I were promenading up and down the library, he told me that he didn't expect to write but one more book, and then he was ready to give up work altogether, die, or do anything. He said that he had written more than he had ever expected to, and the only book that he had been particularly anxious to write was one locked up in the safe downstairs, not yet published. Note, it isn't yet. Title of it, Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven, SLC. But this intended future, of course, will never do, and although Papa usually holds to his own opinions and intents with outsiders, when Mama really desires anything and says that it must be, Papa always gives up his plans, at least so far, and does as she says is right, and she is usually right, if she disagrees with him at all. It was because he knew his great tendency to being convinced by her that he published without her knowledge that article in the Christian Union concerning the government of children. So judging by the proofs of past years, I think that we will be able to persuade Papa to go back to work as before and not leave off writing for the end of his next story. Mama says that she sometimes feels, and I do too, that she would rather have Papa depend on his writing for a living than to have him think of giving it up. Dictated November 8th, 1906. I have a defect of a sort which I think is not common. Certainly, I hope it isn't. It is rare that I can call before my mind's eye the form and face of either friend or enemy. If I should make a list now of persons whom I know in America and abroad, say to the number of even an entire thousand, it is quite unlikely that I could reproduce five of them in my mind's eye. Of my dearest and most intimate friends, I could name eight of whom I have seen and talked with 4 days ago, but when I try to call them before me, they are formless shadows. Jean has been absent this past 8 or 10 days in the country, and I wish I could reproduce her in the mirror of my mind, but I can't do it. It may be that this defect is not constitutional, but a result of lifelong absence of mind and indolence. Mrs. Clemens' eyes, but was not able to even suggest a color for Jean's or Clara's or Susie's. All this talk suggested by Susie's remark the other evening as Papa and I were promenading up and down the library. Down to the bottom of my heart, I am thankful that I can see that picture, and it is not dim, but stands out clear in the unfaded light of 21 years ago. In those days, Susie and I used to promenade daily up and down the library with our arms about each other's waists and deal in intimate communion concerning affairs of state or the deep questions of human life or our small personal affairs. It was quite natural that I should think I had written myself out when I was only 50 years old, for everybody who has ever written has been smitten with that superstition at about that age. Not even yet have I really written myself out. I have merely stopped writing because dictating is pleasanter work, and because dictating has given me a strong aversion to the pen, and because 2 hours of talking per day is enough, and because, but I am only damaging my mind with this digging around in it for pretext where no pretext is needed, and where the simple truth is for this one time better than any invention in this small emergency. I shall never finish my 5 or 6 unfinished books for the reason that by 40 years of slavery to the pen I have earned my freedom. I detest the pen, and I wouldn't use it again to sign the death warrant of my dearest enemy. Dictated March 8th, 1906. For 30 years, I have received an average of 12 letters a year from strangers who remember me or whose fathers remember me as boy and young man. But these letters are almost always disappointing. I have not known these strangers nor their fathers. I have not heard of the names they mention. The reminiscences to which they call attention have had no part in my experience, all of which means that these strangers have been mistaking me for somebody else. But at last I have the refreshment, this morning, of a letter from a man who deals in names that were familiar to me in my boyhood. The writer encloses a newspaper clipping which has been wandering through the press for 4 or 5 weeks, and he wants to know if Captain Tancred, lately deceased, was, as stated in the clipping, the original of Huckleberry Finn. I have replied that Huckleberry Finn was Frank F., as this inquirer evidently knew the Hannibal of the 40s, he will easily recall Frank. Frank's father was at one time town drunkard, an exceedingly well-defined and unofficial office of those days. He succeeded General Gaines, and for a time he was sole and only incumbent of the office, but afterward, Jimmy Finn proved competency and disputed the place with him. So we had 2 town drunkards at one time, and it made as much trouble in that village as Christendom experienced in the 14th century. to repent and resolve to lead a better life. I can remember those awful thunder bursts and the white glare of the lightning yet, and the wild flashing of the rain against the window panes. By my teachings, I perfectly well knew what all that wild riot was for. Satan had come to get Injun Joe. I had no shadow of doubt about it. It was the proper thing when a person like Injun Joe was required in the underworld, and I should have thought it strange and unaccountable if Satan had come for him in a less impressive way. With every glare of lightning, I shriveled and shrunk together in mortal terror, and in the interval of black darkness that followed, I poured out my lamentings over my lost condition and my supplications for just one more chance, with an energy and feeling and sincerity quite foreign to my nature. But in the morning, I saw that it was a false alarm, and concluded to resume business at the old stand and wait for another reminder. The axiom says, history repeats itself. A week or two ago, Mr. Blank Blank dined with us. At dinner, he mentioned a circumstance which flashed me back over about 60 years and landed me in that little bedroom on that tempestuous night, and brought to my mind how creditable to me was my conduct through the whole night, and how barren it was of moral spot or fleck during that entire period. He said Mr. X was sexton or something of the Episcopal Church in his town, and had been for many years the competent superintendent of all the church's worldly affairs, and was regarded by the whole congregation as a stay, a blessing, a priceless treasure. But he had a couple of defects, not large defects, but they seemed large when flung against the background of his profoundly religious character. He drank a good deal, and he could outswear a brakeman. A movement arose to persuade him to lay aside these vices, and after consulting with his pal, who occupied the same position as himself in the other Episcopal Church, and whose defects were duplicates of his own, and had inspired regret in the congregation he was serving, they concluded to try for reform, not wholesale, but half the time. They took the liquor pledge and waited for results. During 9 days, the results were entirely satisfactory, and they were recipients of many compliments and much congratulation. Then, on New Year's Eve, they had business a mile and a half uptown, just beyond the state line. Everything went well with them, Yes, it's number two is all right and sound up to date. We are full of hope. Blank blank said, X, of course you have troubles like other people, but they never show on the outside. I have never seen you when you are not cheerful. Are you always cheerful? Really always cheerful? Well, no, he said. No, I can't say that I am always cheerful, but, well, you know that kind of a night that comes. Say you wake up way in the night and the whole world is sunk in gloom and there are storms and earthquakes and all sorts of disasters in the air threatening and you get cold and clammy. And when that happens to me, I recognize how sinful I am and it all goes clear to my heart and rings it and I have such terrors and terrors. Oh, they are indescribable, those terrors that assail me. And I slip out of bed and get on my knees and pray and pray and promise that I will be good if I could only have another chance. And then, you know, in the morning the sun shines out so lovely and the birds sing and the whole world is so beautiful. And God, I rally. Now I will quote a brief paragraph from this letter which I have a minute ago spoken of. The writer says, "You no doubt are at a loss to know who I am. I will tell you. In my younger days, I was a resident of Hannibal, Missouri. You and I were schoolmates attending Mr. Dawson's school along with Sam and Bill Bowen and Annie Fuqua and others whose names I have forgotten. seldom or never noticing how large a significance it bears, it stands for a curious and interesting fact with a sleeping or waking, dreaming or talking. The thoughts which swarm through our heads are almost constantly, almost continuously accompanied by a like swarm of reminders of incidents and episodes of our past. A man can never know what a large traffic this commerce of association carries on in our minds until he sets out to write his autobiography. He then finds that a thought is seldom born to him that does not immediately remind him of some event, large or small, in his past experience. Quite naturally, these remarks remind me of various things, among others, this, that sometimes a thought, by the power of association, will bring back to your mind a lost word or a lost name, which you have not been able to recover by any other process known to your mental equipment. Yesterday we had an instance of this. Reverend Joseph H. Twitchell is with me on this flying trip to Bermuda. He was with me on my last visit to Bermuda, and today we are trying to remember when it was. We thought it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 years ago, but that was as near as we could get it to date. Twitchell said that the landlady in whose boarding house we sojourned in that ancient time could doubtless furnish us the date, and we must look her up. We wanted to see her anyway because she and her blooming daughter of 18 were the only persons whose acquaintance we had made at that time, for we were traveling under fictitious names, and people who wear aliases were not given to seeking society and bringing themselves under suspicion. But at this point in our talk, we encountered an obstruction. We could not recall the landlady's name. We hunted all around through our minds for that name, using all the customary methods of research, but without success. The name was gone from us, apparently permanently. We finally gave the matter up and fell to talking about something else. The talk wandered from one subject to another and finally arrived at Twitchell school days in Hartford, the Hartford of something more than half a century ago, and he mentioned several of his schoolmasters, drawing with special interest upon the peculiarities of an ancient one named Olney. He remarked that Olney, humble village schoolmaster as he was, Was that on that day the Reverend Mr. Kuchel, bearing the assumed name of Peters, had made a statement to her which she regarded as a fiction? I remember the circumstance very well. We had bidden the young girl goodbye and had gone 50 yards, perhaps, when Kuchel said he had forgotten something. I must go back. When he rejoined me, he was silent. This alarmed me, because I had not seen an example of it before. He seemed quite uncomfortable, and I asked him what the trouble was. He said he had been inspired to give the girl a pleasant surprise, and so had gone back and said to her, "That young fellow's name is not Wilkinson, that's Mark Twain." She did not lose her mind. She did not exhibit any excitement at all, but said quite simply, quite tranquilly, "Tell it to the Marines, Mr. Peters, if that should happen to be your name." It was very pleasant to meet her again. We were light-headed, but she was not. In the sweet and unvexed spiritual atmosphere of the Bermudas, one does not achieve gray hairs at 48. I had a dream last night, and of course it was born of association, like nearly everything else that trips into a person's head, asleep or awake. On board ship, on the passage down, Kuchel was talking about the swiftly developing possibilities of serial navigation, and he quoted those striking verses of Tennyson's which forecast the future when airborne vessels of war shall meet and fight above the clouds and redden the earth below with a rain of blood. This picture of carnage and blood and death reminded me of something which I had read a fortnight ago. Statistics of railway accidents compiled by the United States government, wherein the appalling fact was set forth that on our 200,000 miles of railway, we annually kill 10,000 persons outright and injure 80,000. The warships in the air suggested the railway horrors, and 3 nights afterwards the railway horrors suggested my dream. The work of association was going on in my head unconsciously all that time. It was an admirable dream, but there was of it. In it I saw a funeral procession. I saw it from a mountain peak. I saw it crawling along and curving here and there, serpent-like, through a level, vast plain. I seemed to see 100 miles of the procession, but neither the beginning of it nor the end of it was within the limits of my vision. The procession was in 10 divisions, each division marked by a somber flag, and the whole